Welcome to HTB Stories, a podcast brought to you by Hacktbox. Today's episode features an AMA with Live Overflow. Do you want to know when we do events live and participate in the discussion or even ask your own questions? Join our Discord at discord.gg/hacktbox. And now, on to the AMA.
Hello all. How are you? Greetings from Hacktbox. It's us once again, and we with another AMA, and we could not be happier because today with us, we have the one, the only, the amazing, the notorious, I have not enough words to say, Live Overflow. Let's give a big shout out, a big hug, a big thumbs up. I don't know what else to say. I'm obviously very excited. So let's give it to Live O. Hello, how are you?
Hi, I'm very good. Thank you. How are you?
I'm good. I'm very happy and excited that we have you here with us today. It was like one of the things that we're discussing with other content creators. You were like, and we're like, okay, so I'm very happy that we have this opportunity with us today. How is the weather over there?
Cold. It's getting cold. It's very fall weather here.
Yeah.
But it's nice because now less people around. I have a dog, so I have to walk the dog, and I like it when there is a bit less people around.
Okay, that's good. What's his name or her name?
His name is Frito. The name is derived from the American snack, the Fritos flavor twists, because its color is like a snack.
Okay. So I could do an introduction about yourself. That Live Overflow is the one that we know from YouTube. He has created the amazing Pony Island, amazing city of videos for DEFCON, for the Real World CTF, amazing stuff, an amazing April Fool's video. Before we start, I was telling about it, how much I loved it. Videos about hacking concepts, videos about hacking mindset. I don't know if you can pick one or say anything, but do you want to present yourself, who you are and what you do for the people that maybe don't know you?
Yeah, I guess I can summarize that I've been working in IT security for about like 8 years or so doing security audits. And then around like 6 years ago, I started Live Overflow YouTube channel where I wanted to make hacking tutorials because I was craving these kind of videos and they didn't exist. And yeah, since then, there are a couple of formats on the channel, but I really like the tutorial format. I have several ongoing series that I also kind of completed, multiple episodes. But I have also single videos about bug write-ups, how they were discovered or how they were exploited. I have many CTF write-ups. CTFs are a big part of what I've been doing. And then also some vloggy style videos, some things that happened. Yeah.
Amazing. And before we start, do you have like your favorite video? The one that you created and really meant for you the most?
I don't have a particular video I like, but I have tons of video that I really, really like where after the fact, I think that was a good video. And these are videos that usually have a little bit of a unique concept. One, for example, is I made a video about the Pokemon Game Boy game. And there was a glitch to for a Pokemon missing node to appear, and it would multiply your items. And this is a well-known glitch, and it has been researched a lot, and people have documented it online. But I like to approach it again and try to bridge it over to maybe IT security, show that hunting for glitches or explaining glitches in a Pokemon game is the same skills that you need for hacking as well. And I try to approach it in a way, how could this glitch have been discovered and how can we understand how it happened without relying on somebody else telling it to us? So basically making a video about us rediscovering it. And these are the kind of videos that where I, after the fact, I think, this is really nice. I like this a lot. This is a unique perspective that didn't exist as a resource before. And those are the kinds of videos that I'm very, very proud of afterwards.
Very nice. It's actually that one I enjoyed also myself. And I really...
So sorry, you are cutting out. Okay, in case you hear me, I cannot hear you.
Okay, hello? So it's fixed.
Am I back? Am I back? I can hear you.
Yes, you can hear me?
I can hear you, yeah.
Perfectly. We had some issues, connectivity issues. I can understand what happened. You hacked us already?
Could have been my side. I don't know. I couldn't hear you, so it could have been my internet.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Okay. So let's maybe start with our first questions that we have today. So all guys, we did the survey 3 weeks ago. We had it on our social and you could submit your questions. Also, some people will get for their questions a gift card of swag and also a gift from Live-O. We sent him as a thank you a gift card, but he said he doesn't want it and to give it away to someone else. So make sure to leave your questions, and one question we'll get from Live-O a gift. So let's jump onwards the questions. Let's jump in the first one. Banners. Okay. So let's start. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. So, which moment served as the entry point for you as your interest in hacking?
I would say there are two moments, because the first one was when I was a teenager, when I was generally developing an interest in hacking. But that was just like, I thought hacking was cool. I saw it in movies. And there was a book, The Cuckoo's Egg, which is a story about a hacking attack that happened in the 80s, maybe. But it's a great book. I enjoyed it a lot as a teenager, and I thought hacking was really cool. So this was the time as a young teenager, 12, 13, maybe, where I developed an interest, oh, hacking is cool. But I wasn't able to get into it. And so the second moment that was very meaningful as a moment to actually get into hacking was when I discovered CTFs when I was a student. I was like 20 years old or so when I discovered CTFs.
Okay, that's really interesting. And when did you find out though that, okay, hacking is, this is what I want to do. Like, I leave everything else, hacking is my calling.
So when I discovered CTFs at 20, I was studying computer science. So I always loved computer stuff and programming. Mm-hmm. So I was set on a path to become a developer. And then I started to learn about security. But realistically, I understood that, you know, my little bit of security knowledge wouldn't be enough to work in security. But I was happy mm-hmm. to become a developer still at that time. So I was also applying for a web development job. But then I decided after my bachelor's degree that I would like to continue studying. So I went to do a master's degree. And during all this time on the side, I kept learning more and more about IT security. And I had a ton of luck by meeting a person who knew a person who got me into a freelance position where on my free time, when there was a project, I could work on it. And these kind of projects became more and more. And suddenly I had a job in IT security. But to this day, I still like development a lot. And I could actually imagine to, at some point, to not have like a pure security job, but I could totally imagine to be some kind of IT architect or something, but having a okay. focus on security, using my knowledge to build up, you know, from the ground up safe or safer applications or something like that.
But you told me before that you loved developing. So it's not that you have left that part. Almost like you continue to do almost everything.
Yeah, I love development. For me, programming is an integral part of hacking. I read code in my job all the time. This is the main job I do. I read code. And so I wouldn't be able to read code if I wouldn't know how to, at least to some extent, know how to program in that code. Yeah, so I mean, hackers hack software and software has to be developed. So to me, it's like, if I love cars, I want to understand the engine. So if I love hacking, I want to understand, you know, what drives the whole hacking universe, and that is software, and that has to be developed. So yeah, for me, development has as much to do with security as hacking itself.
So if you start car hacking, you will just open your gun and try to hack it all the way?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, this would be interesting. Make sure to make a video about it, if you do.
Yeah.
It would be amazing, because you have a hardware hacking series, so who knows. Okay, let's go to the next question. What's one skill or concept you wish you could tell your younger self to learn?
Actually, I don't really know what I would recommend, because I'm very, very satisfied like with my path I had. There's nothing I would necessarily change. There's nothing I would say this was a huge mistake or you should have learned this earlier. I'm very, very pleased with how everything went. So it's hard to say learn this concept first. But maybe I could say and reinforce things I'm like proud of my past self to have done, and that is stay with like development, do programming, learn about, you know, how websites are built and learn these programming concepts, because now later, now that I focus more on hacking it, I still use the experience and knowledge about how stuff was built, because I always think to myself, how could this have been built and what could have been the mistakes? And so I'm very happy that I stuck with programming for such a long time. And I worry that maybe if I had like discovered security a bit earlier, that I would have tried to jump into security earlier. And I'm very, very happy having that programming knowledge.
Okay. But if it was, okay, that is a concept and a skill that has to do with, you know, with knowledge. What if it is a soft skill? If you had to choose a soft skill to have younger or to teach yourself younger, what would that be?
Okay, so the other thing is I always love to do presentations. One of the important soft skills, I think, for hackers is how to present the things well at conferences, but also now the modern format in videos, some basic editing skills, some basic ways to make it just look a bit nicer, some basic principles. These are important things, but in school, I love to do presentations. I was always, I mean, maybe they weren't great, but I feel like when I was a teenager in school, when I was young, I did already presentation skills and so forth. Then there are other skills like networking and small talk that I'm not particularly good at. I wish I could be better at it, but I also don't know how to learn that. Yeah, if you can practice and be better at small talk is great for networking, and I'm really bad at it, but I also wouldn't know how to tell my younger self how to do that.
I have a tip though, if you want.
For leave that. The apartment, are you saying I should go outside?
No, it's not. It is similar to what you said. I had to do a presentation at my previous work. And I was very anxious because I had to do the tech presentation, but to present it very detailed in a very low level so everyone understands. Plus, it will be tons of people. And I was like a system level, I don't know, minus 100. And it was like to the whole company, so I was very anxious. And the thing that my manager by then told me that fake till you make it. Say it again and again and again and again. So he asked me the same question again and again until I became fluent with it. So exactly fake it till you make it. And about small talk, because I also get very anxious when I speak with people. You might have understood that in the past. Ask them questions, because everyone is interested and always open to speak about themselves, at least at specific topics. So if you are not comfortable speaking about yourself, you don't know what to do, ask. Like, what's your job? Ah, okay, and what do you do there? That's very interesting. And so, well, that helps a lot to get you out of yourself. This is what I can understand. Because otherwise, there are many times, my friends can justify, I just sit around in the corner or at some stairs alone. It's not very nice, but yeah.
Well, see, there's maybe the difference. I like to sit in the corner and just watch the people. I don't mind that I don't talk to people, but it certainly helps grow your professional network, helps to get a job and so forth. So sometimes you got to force yourself out of that corner to, you know, to get opportunities and everything.
I agree. Next question. I do. We do like half live overflow MEA, half life coaching today. Balance. Okay. So looking back at your hiking journey so far and the progress you've made on the way, what's one thing you could do differently? Okay.
As I said, like, I'm very satisfied with my path that I took, and that's not necessarily a mistake, I would say, I made or so. But there's one thing, and that is, I started with getting into security just before bug bounties became a thing. And then bug bounties started to become a thing. And I read about these amazing hackers that would, you know, suddenly make a lot of money from bug bounties. And back then I told myself, every bug was already found. I would never find a bug in Google. I would never like earn a lot of money because all these amazing bug hunters already found everything. And that was like 6-7 years ago or so. And today we have still bug hunters finding tons and tons of bugs and making lots of money. And that was just such a huge mistake to back then tell myself I shouldn't even try. Everything is found. I have no chance, because looking back now, you know, there were 6 years full of amazing bug bounty findings and people still finding stuff and still easy stuff. So it's not like that the bugs went like much more complex or something. Things I totally understand and I know I could have found, but I was too scared at the time, thinking already everything was found. And I feel like if I hadn't had that holding me back, I would have totally went down like the bug bounty path and would today talk more about bug bounty than CTFs or so.
Okay, but that I think that doesn't stop you in order to do that. That is also from a Google CTF, I told you. Yeah. I'm very proud, that's why I wear it today. But why don't you do now more bug bounties?
Well, because now I have the same thought. Every good bug is already found. It's getting too hard and I wouldn't find anything. It's still the same thought that's holding me back. So
yeah. I understand.
But, so maybe to the people starting now, you know, as I said, like 6 years ago, I had the same thought, and we now know from the future that the years after that, a lot of bugs were found. And 5 years in the future, you will look back to today and know that also a lot of bugs have been found in Google and other pages. So there are still many, many bugs to be found.
Okay, nice. Yes, of course. The world is your oyster. So hack the planet, but responsibly. So next question. What music do you like listening to when you're hacking or programming? Or if you hear a different kind of music each time?
There are two things I listen to. It's either, actually there are three now, but I like to have just YouTube videos or movies or series on in the background, just playing, just like back in the days you would have the radio or the TV on in the background. But if I get like really in the focus and if it's like dark and I really, really get into the mood and in the tunnel, then it's drum and bass. Drum and bass is really like, then I'm sitting there doing like this and then I'm just coding or hacking and yeah, that's the total music. And then just recently I started listening to audiobooks. So that's, I'm currently in a phase of listening to audiobooks, but yeah, drum and bass is like, if I think about the cool hacking moments of my from myself, it's always with drum and bass.
Yeah, I agree. Drum and bass the best, because also it can help you focus. Even if you're in your office and you this listen to, because it has a specific beat, it's almost like it's programming your mind to be here and present what you do now. Although they think that it's very light and you cannot concentrate, it actually does the other. It zones you out from anyone else and you just concentrate there.
Yeah, and it's not too complex with the melodies or so that they would be distracting too much as well. So it's like just really a mood. It gives you the right mood for the moment.
Then you could create, I don't know if you have, I haven't shared, a Spotify list by Lab Overflow for hacking. That would be.
I made a tweet like a few months ago about asking about somebody having a drum and bass playlist. Then somebody shared one and that's the one I'm listening to right now. So I don't have my own. I also just stole it from somebody.
Okay, me too. So next, what is experience cybersecurity that has affected you the most?
I mean, there were tons of moments. I've been in it now for such a long time. But I think one of the earliest and scariest things is the adrenaline rush. For example, I was living with a friend who was developing a browser game, and then I started hacking around on this browser game and kind of ruined it to some extent, just temporarily. And he didn't know what was happening. His community was like going wild about like hackings and weird stuff happening. And so he realized that I was doing stuff, and he was extremely angry. But I didn't realize that what I was doing was like so bad to him, because in the moment I was like driven by this adrenaline feeling. And I had this adrenaline feeling a few times during that period. I would get this adrenaline rush and go blind and just like do like worse and worse things with like actually exploiting things or something and causing like harm. And it took then a bit to realize, but when you come down from the adrenaline rush, I realized what you have done. And so, and I had like two or three of these kind of moments where I realized I did really something, like I hurt people because I was, you know, hurting their projects, their what they put so much heart into it, and I was like destroying it, kind of, even if it was just, you know, fixable everything, but those people were very upset. And since then, I don't feel like I ever had this kind of adrenaline rush anymore, but I think it's good. It went too far, and I'm glad that I haven't been chasing this more. But I think it's very dangerous. So if you feel the adrenaline rush coming up, slow down.
It can go bad. But also, what happened? Because you said that with your friend. Like, it's not that I'm like, did you apologize or did everything end up okay?
I of course, he didn't know what was exactly happening in the browser game. He just knew that, you know, people were complaining, things happened, and that a hacker is around and so forth. And obviously he knew it was me then. And so he wasn't sure, like, if I destroyed the game completely, if I just messed with a small part, you know, he was upset. He didn't know what was happening. But so, of course, I explained to him what exactly I did and what the bugs were. And then, you know, we spoke and everything got cleared up. So of course I apologized and told him what the issues were, and he forgave me.
But you didn't report it like immediately when you found it.
No. Yeah, he found out through, he had like his built-in forum in the browser game, and he found out because. Okay. So it was like a strategy game where one army could attack the other army, and I was able to create armies that did not exist, which caused then the fight to always, I win always because my non-existent units could never die. So basically I would always win, and they would see in the battle report that there was these unexisting armies being used and so forth. So they didn't, like, they went crazy, of course. And he just noticed that things were going weird, and
Okay. Interesting. I love that you're honest at least. And it's good that you're also, yes, it's nice to have the adrenaline rush, and in everything in life, count to five maybe to understand. I'm also very impulsive, so I have to do it myself. But yeah. Next question. Okay, so do you remember the first security flaw that you found? Oh, very nice question. And what was it?
So there's the first security flaw I experienced myself. And this was when I was, an old hobby of mine is like pen spinning, doing tricks with pens. And back then there were competitions at small tournaments, and I wanted to program a website where people could compete against each other. And there was a comment section, and somebody found an XSS, but at the time I didn't know what an XSS was. It was just weird to me. So this was the first like security flaw I kind of got in contact with. But the first security flaw that I actually then found myself was SQL injection. So at the time I was doing web development, and the old style of making SQL queries with string concatenation. So SQL queries were a very common and widespread thing.
Okay. And now that you say about your first security flaw, do you remember your first video that you created?
I mean, the first videos I created were about binary exploitation, about basic buffer overflows. But these were, of course, not issues I found in a real software. They were in a test application. And then the very first CTF I played was also binary exploitation. that was also a basic buffer overflow.
Okay, that's very nice. And if, let's say, so if you place it if now, what is your go-to? It is web or phone?
Yeah, I usually play web because, so I like to play, when I play, I like to play, you know, the big known CTFs. They have challenges that are really, really hard and really push often the boundaries of what's known or what you know about web security. And I use that to learn. So, and because web security is mostly my job, doing code audits of web applications. So in these kind of CTFs, I usually go to web because this is where I have the most experience. I know I'm pretty familiar with like the state of the art, what's currently like the trend of web vulnerabilities. And then I still can learn because they obviously introduce new stuff in those kind of CTFs, things you didn't know or, yeah. And so this is where I have the biggest chance to even succeed in these kind of CTFs because they are so hard.
Okay, that's interesting. So you found, the CTFs educational.
Mm-hmm.
I agree, because in if you're a pen tester, I love the thing that you did with the pen testing. when you're a pen tester, you cannot always know because you do sometimes same around technologies, but through CTF, because they say a lot of for our content also that's very too CTF-y. It's not very too CTF-y. That the fact that we have not seen it doesn't mean that it will not happen.
Absolutely.
Thank you for justifying it. Another person.
Yeah, and it's very important to me to play CTFs with my job because you can get very complacent in your job. You get paid to look for vulnerabilities in a client's application. They pay you because they don't know what kind of vulnerabilities they have. They pay you to do a good job in trying to find as many as you can or as many weaknesses they have. So they don't know. So you can tell them anything. You could tell them you found nothing or there is nothing and they would be happy because they don't know. And it only comes out if they get hacked or if they pay somebody else in the future or so. So it's a job where you can fake a lot and still make clients happy. But I need to remind myself, and this is like a personal bias that happens. Like you do this daily, and you need to be careful that you don't become complacent and think, oh, I'm an expert. I didn't find anything or only found these few things, so I'm happy now. And CTFs remind me, oh, you know, there are potential bugs that could exist that I cannot find, and that is keeping me motivated and remind me, you know, dude, you need to learn more and keep learning. Yeah, otherwise you will become complacent and lazy. It might never come out that you are, but I want to do as good job as possible. And so I need to be very mindful of reminding myself that there could be bugs I don't know about, and CTFs keep reminding me of that.
I know that we have changed a lot from the initial discussion, but I want to ask you something. How do you feel when you cannot solve something? Is it take you down, or you say, okay, we'll wait after to read the write-up? And like, how do you deal with something that you cannot solve?
Yeah, I don't mind at all. I guess the good thing is I have throughout the years solved and not solved so many challenges. So a new challenge for me is not something big and scary. It's just another challenge. And if I don't solve it, I don't solve it. I'm happy because then I can learn usually something new. Sometimes it was something stupid, guessy. Then I'm mad afterwards and think this was stupid. This was just guessing something that wasn't really something cool. Then I'm mad. But otherwise, I'm just happy to learn something new. And as I said, because it's nothing big or special to me, it's just another challenge, I don't mind. Now, when somebody is starting out and, you know, does their first challenge, their second challenge, or even their 10th challenge, those are so few challenges that you remember every one of them, and they feel very big to you. And if you fail them, it might feel very, very bad. So I can understand that can be very frustrating. But if you have done hundreds of challenges, at some point you don't really care about a particular challenge anymore, and you just move on.
Makes sense. But did you feel like that at first? So you had the same mindset by then, or you, like at first when you're like at your 20-year-old self that you said, how was the 20-year-old life?
I can be very obsessive with stuff. So I would just, so the first ETFs I played were not these kind of, over a weekend, like time gated. It was more like Hack the Box or so, like war games where you have as much time as you want. So I would just get very, very obsessed with single challenges where I would just, you know, spend the next 4 or 5 days, like day and night. I was a student, so I could just ignore classes and just like in the class, keep working on it. I was so obsessed with war games at the time that I didn't mind to just like lose myself in it. I knew that they were easier challenges, so it was also realistic, and eventually I would solve them. And there were some very hard stuff I attempted, but of course I gave up. But, you know, I had a lot of success with the first few challenges, but, you know, it took me days to solve some of them. But yeah, I was just very obsessed.
Okay. Me too. Me too. Oh, and if I could advise my younger self, it would be to, I don't know, to feel less bad when you do not achieve something, because no one knows everything. You will never be the best. Just try, just learn, don't get frustrated. It actually works the opposite way. Yeah. So, yeah.
And you can redefine what the success is. Obviously, a CTF, you think the success is finding the flag and entering in the field, and then you press the button and that's the success. But when you redefine your success and you just want to learn something new, then even when you start digging into the challenge, you most likely will learn something new, because you start Googling, you start reading stuff, even if it's unrelated, you will learn a few small things, and that's success. And suddenly, you know, it doesn't matter if you enter the flag at the end, because you redefined what the success is for you in that case.
Exactly. It's a success even if you learn something, or by research, even if you don't find anything. Very nice discussion. Let's go to the next. In subject of your IT security career, if you kind of go back in time and talk to yourself, what's the best advice in a matter of do and do not?
Yeah. I guess kind of mentioned the things already. Generally, I'm very happy with the path I took. There's not big do's or don'ts, or necessarily don'ts I wouldn't do, and do's all the stuff I did. Like, I don't mind jumping between topics around, for example. Like, I didn't hyper-focus on web security, but I did hardware, web, programming, crypto, you know, all the different fields. I think that I'm happy I did that. That is a do. I would tell myself, do CTFs. Probably I would also say, do bug bounty back then. That would have been a fun time, to spend my time back then. If you feel the adrenaline rush when you hack something real, be careful. Stop yourself.
The pain. Okay, so let's go to the next. What software do you feel that is severely underrated?
There are amazing softwares for hacking like Burp Suite or so that are just so integral and are known and everybody knows it already, so it's not really underrated. Generally, I like to code a lot my own scripts, but everybody knows that as well, that you can write your own script, so that's also not necessarily underrated. Maybe for those people who don't have much programming experience yet, I do feel like do not underestimate the power of being able to script your own small tools and automations. Quickly make them up. You basically write your own features that some tools don't have and you need in the moment. It's not really underrated, I would say. So it's I don't know. And also, I personally don't use a lot of tools, so I don't have, I cannot tell you, use this one tool on GitHub that nobody knows about. It's great, because I often write my own stuff, and I rather, for example, write something that interacts with Burp and helps me, you know, maybe a small like extension or something that does something with Burp, rather than trying to find a tool that then does the things, something or so. Yeah.
Okay. But you use Burp.
Yeah, I use Burp, for example. Yeah.
Okay. That's very nice. And what you said has a very nice meaning, because instead of trying to always find a tool to do the work for you, for example, I don't want to trash any tool or anything, but instead to find, like, in order to create a malware or to create something, it's better for you to research it yourself, or to attack something by yourself, or to try to set up the hunter, everything by yourself, then, because then you actually know how to work, and these are the things that are not flagged, or the things that will work the most, and you can actually learn a lot by developing. So,
I understand that it's slower. I think I could be a lot more efficient if I would have a tool set at hand I would know very well and could use. And that's certainly something, for example, where I think I could improve on that with some tools to be faster in what I do. But I personally am so scared of missing stuff and not really understanding what I'm doing and not really understanding what the tool does. For example, if it's like a basic web vulnerability scanner, Nikto or something like this, and I throw it against the target, at the end, I don't know, did it check now for this and this bug I have in mind? Now I'm rechecking everything anyway, because I don't know if the scanner checked for it or not, or if rate limiting responses cause the scanner to report something wrong. Maybe there is something there, but the scanner didn't realize that at some point there was a rate limiting error returned, or things like that. I don't know. So I prefer to do as much as possible by hand, even though it's very slow and inefficient, but I feel a lot more comfortable doing that.
But okay, but how are you going to check for directories?
Sure. Of course you use some scanner, but you know, you can use them Burp Intruder or something, or I write my own script even.
And then
you know, you start, you know, there's tons of tools to do directory brute forcing, but then you have apps where you need weird authentication. You need to authenticate every 5 minutes again, or there's always something weird. And I know these tools can often be configured. They can often be hooked up with some, I don't know, whatever, small scripts additionally that do certain things for you before, I don't know, like, a lot of tools are extensible in this way, but I don't know. In the end, it's much faster it feels much easier for me to write a small Python script that just does what I want for this particular website. It takes 30 minutes, but then I have it, and then, you know, it's fine.
Okay. That's very nice. I totally agree. I don't think I was ever that skilled in order to create some scripts to automate some of the things that I could do to start, like, scan these things at Nmap and just add the parameter and just start this other scanner and just like that. Like, things to automate these kind of things, that is also very helpful and very educational.
Yeah.
So next question that we have today is, what makes you stay in the field? Why do you stay in security?
There's always new stuff to learn. There are always new technologies coming out. I'm a very curious person in general. I have a very obsessive mind, so I can always obsessed in learning new stuff. It doesn't have to be security. It can be literally anything. Just recently, I got into camping videos, and now I'm learning about the forests and stuff like that. It's just things catch me, and I'm curious. And this field is amazing because it's so fast changing, and you can be constantly curious and learn new stuff. There are so many different areas. I like to jump between different areas of security, and there's always new stuff to learn. And the stuff that gets me really excited is when I see a bit more complex bug chains, like vulnerabilities that exploit a few different bugs, or a puzzle piece falling into place. And I find this just very beautiful, and that gives me then a huge feeling of satisfaction. And awe, and yeah, those are the kind of things that keep the flame up, so to speak.
Okay, that's right. I totally agree, and it's something also. I know it's not for me, this IMEA, but it's like it's there seems a feeling here in the heart that without it, something is missing. Like if you love a candy a lot, or like a dessert or something to drink, it's something that you really need. Then no, at least for me. So, what place will AI have in the future of InfoSec?
Yeah, I don't know. So first of all, I don't think that AI will do any kind of like automated hacking or anything. Anything crazy like that. There's like one thing I think where it will have impact. I really like the idea of GitHub Copilot, automated code generation, basically. I do think that there are a lot of like coding patterns that are always the same, and a tool like this, I think, could really help even less experienced programmers to, in the end, write good code. Of course, it will also introduce bugs. Of course, it will recommend buggy code as well. But I do feel like there's a future there where smart code is generated in a safe way. Do an example, like to say, I want to do an SQL query, and instead of like trusting the first, I don't know, search result that tells me about string concatenating for SQL queries, I trust Copilot to find, you know, modern code with proper prepared statements or something like this. And yeah, I think like coding help like this, I think, could have a crazy impact on secure coding, and thus it has impact on InfoSec. And then there are small things like pattern recognition in general.
Yeah.
As a bug hunter or hacker in general, you often observe huge amounts of data and you try to find like weird small stuff in it. So for example, when I run in burp, I run intruder, basically just fuzzing a parameter, and I fuzz a particular parameter with weird inputs. I then start looking through the list of all requests to notice weird stuff. And then I use, you know, sorting by...
error code. By code, like by the code that gave...
Yeah, for example, the code, exactly. If there's a response with a weird return code, or also by response size, because...
response size, the best, yeah, of course.
There's a few things, but it's very manual and it's very easy, so not necessarily you need AI for that. But I could imagine that AI could help with kind of this finding weird patterns in a huge amount of scanning data that helps you identify interesting stuff, maybe. And for example, it's an idea for a tool I had for many years, but I don't know enough about AI to implement it myself. It's kind of like URL path prediction kind of thing. So we have directory lists and you can just throw scanners, but an AI could maybe learn to make up URL paths and parameters based on a huge data set of known stuff, where, you know, AI could automatically try to generate the most likely next directory name or parameter name for this. And then maybe it could be trained with the application itself. So while the application is scanning itself, it can learn how programmers were choosing the parameter names, can then predict, if programmers use this kind of pattern for names, then likely this could be a proper thing. Like something like this. I feel like there's bachelor thesis there or master thesis there maybe, but I'm not sure. Maybe it sounds so plausible that somebody else has implemented this already, but I haven't seen it yet. So
okay. Yeah. That's very interesting though. But okay, in that concept, the algorithm, the AI at the end, how would base the results? For example, based because of the software, what is the most common vulnerabilities that were found already, and every pen tester, for example, of the world, they should feed this repo with results, and based on the software, the most probable results would come out, something like that.
Yeah. That would be really cool. Yeah. And the thing is, I don't want it to be a tool where like I come up with the rules, right? It shouldn't be an algorithm where I say if it sees like camel case patterns or something like this, it should predict this and this. It should be a really like neural network AI where you just throw data and it just comes up with the stuff out of nowhere. That would be really cool.
Feed by itself with the data.
That would be cool.
Interesting. Well, we have a huge analytics team also, but everyone from here, if he's an AI master or anything, make sure to Bing Live Overflow for to create this together. So, another question. I'm currently learning cybersecurity, and I was wondering, are there any non-cybersecurity related classes that we really that are especially helpful to cybersecurity? Interesting question.
Yeah, I think communication as a broad sense, but it could be or it should be writing skills, presentation skills, and basic video editing. I think being able to communicate your findings well is extremely important. A lot of the, you know, there are a lot of frustrations, for example, in the bug bounty community where reports are get rejected and so forth. And I read those reports and I sit in front of it and think, I'm experienced, I do this for 10 years and I do not understand what you write in your report. How do you think a triage understands what you write? Okay. So I think a huge important skill, and that will, you know, help you to succeed in the industry, is when you are able to write and communicate very well about your bugs, or make small videos, editing, understand, being, and this the important aspect of that is being able to emphasize with the reader, putting yourself into their shoes and think about what is really the important information I have to give so they can reproduce it and so forth. Yeah, I think that is a skill that you should focus on.
Yeah. And also, I know that is not a skill, but I see a lot of people that are focusing on chess now. I don't know if it's just us, but everyone in the company is playing chess.
They were playing
chess. Yeah, everyone. So I don't know how that helps, because I don't know personally, but I see everyone is very passionate about it, and that is very distressing, actually. And why I think I couldn't do it ever, because it's like you have to wait for the others more. While you're going to pen test, it's just you and the machine.
Right.
So that's interesting.
Yeah, I guess maybe a bit of like strategic games in general, have the time to think, like round-based games where you have the time to think, where you need to have a strategy, where you need to react on the strategy of the opponent. I guess that can like practice your analytical skills and thinking
exactly
ahead and acting on new information and things like that.
Yeah. Another question, the next one. How do you keep up with so many different fields of cybersecurity? Is just by playing CTFs?
Mostly, I would say it's CTFs and of course write-ups that exist, and people do bug write-ups. So on Twitter, once in a while, something interesting flies by. And then of course, now I'm also working for so many years, and our clients, like the cool stuff about the clients I have is that we do not have like the big old dinosaur clients, but we have like young startups. And so they are always cutting edge with the technologies they use. Which means there's less information about those kind of things on online. And so you have to make up your own kind of new threat surfaces. You have to uncover like what's the threat surface for this kind of technology and so forth. And so it's also kind of like doing your own research, reading the source code of the technologies that your client is using to understand it better and so forth. So it's a mix of playing CTFs, reading what people write and share on Twitter, and just doing it yourself on the job because it's necessary in the moment.
Now that you said reading, do you read hacking books?
No.
No.
I started reading the Hacking the Art of Exploitation many, many years ago. I have a hard time. I have a super hard time reading. I'm too impatient for reading. I need that's why I have like TV stuff running in the background when I'm working on the PC. I need like input all the time, and reading is too, I don't know, I just can't get myself.
No, don't worry. For me, at least I can completely understand you, and you get impatient also at the end, so you just want to go through and understand what's going.
That's kind of why I make videos as well, because you know, video resources didn't really exist when I started, and I wish there were video resources, so I just started making them myself.
But okay, I know that it's another question from one, so we will remove this one. How did you decide to start YouTube videos and teach cybersecurity? Because I think you are the pioneer, and you were, I think, the first.
I guess the first serious one. There were always like people experimenting, of course, before. But so for example, more like the first I know about, because otherwise, if I would have seen somebody else do it, I would have just watched their videos. I wouldn't have saw myself. But there were a few things coming together. But the most impactful one was watching GeoHot playing a CTF live and streaming himself, and looking over the shoulder of a professional was so incredible to me, because I've never seen this before. I never had the chance to look like a real hacker over the shoulder, how they work. And so seeing that for the first time was for me an incredible learning resource, and I just was craving more, and it didn't really exist. So I started live streaming. That's also Live Overflow. And then I realized I was terrible at live streaming, so I moved over to making videos. So, but then of course it was a mix of stuff. Like, I wish there were video tutorials that didn't exist. I felt like the resources to learn buffer overflows were overly complicated, and I felt like it's so easy once you get it. Why are these resources so bad? Kind of feeling. they maybe were not bad. I don't know, but I wish they were. It would have been taught a bit differently, and so that kind of was feeding the motivation to start tutorial videos. And I want to mention, like, at the time, for example, Hack 5 existed or so, and they were very big. It wasn't the hacking I was looking for. They did some basic tutorials, like how Metasploit works or how to run Nmap. But what was missing to me was really like the more like security research, how the bugs really work, exploiting really detailed the bugs, understanding buffer overflows, and like a bit deeper, a bit more technical, not necessarily like the bit higher level tool using stuff.
Interesting. So you took matter to your own hands and you created this. Nice. And I love this question, the next one. As an experienced CTF player, how you keep yourself motivated when you're burned out, if you burn out? And thank you for your contribution.
I just don't play then CTFs. The general advice I always give people is just do what is fun to you, because that kind of worked out for me. I just do what is fun to me. And when playing CTFs is fun to me, I play CTFs. And when playing CTFs is no fun for me, I don't play CTFs. So I don't think I ever was like in a situation where I wanted to force myself really to play. If I'm very bad with discipline. So when I don't want to, I cannot really force myself to do it. So I take breaks. So this, like, the large scale. In a small scale, like when I'm sitting at a CTF and I'm losing a bit motivation or I get frustrated, then I just take breaks. I'm an adult. I live alone, so I have to cook. Then taking a break to cook something or taking the dog out. Interruptions like this can then help to refocus again.
Yeah.
Taking a shower.
I like that, taking a shower. Like, there are days in front of a CTF and you remember, it's Tuesday already and it started Saturday. Time to take a shower.
That's right.
It happens. We have to say this. We have to accept. Okay.
And like I want to say is when I like, CTFs is not the only way to learn. I think CTFs are an amazing way to learn because it's gamified. It can be fun. You can learn so much doing it. It's very practical and so forth. Like, I mean, CTFs are awesome. But when you lose motivation for CTFs, then you just need to figure out what are you motivated next for, and you keep doing that. So it might be, then if I lose interest in CTFs, I might move over to do some programming, write some tools, make a new website idea I have, even though I never will finish it. I don't care. I will just start programming on it. I might change the topics. I might have been doing web CTFs, but then I want to do other stuff. You know, nowadays you could look into bug bounties, can spend some time on a program. You could try out different styles of CTF, like Hack the Box has a different style to other challenges, other war games, and so forth. So there's a lot of variety now today, too. So you know, you can just try to figure out, you know, the next thing that tries to motivate you. And there's one trick I have is also sometimes I lose myself in games, and I now I don't care really that much about it anymore. Now I can lose myself into games, but when I was younger and before I got like a job and I was worried about, you know, losing too much time, I tried to use the motivation for the game to do something technical. So I would start, you know, researching something, how the game works, try to hack the game, try to cheat in the game, or write a web application to like track my progress in the game. It could be as simple as then as that, just like a small tool that keeps track of my quests I have to do or something like this. Like I try to redirect my motivation for the game into something technical, and through that I can learn again.
Okay. I don't believe, I don't know if it's good that we say this, but I don't believe we have someone here that plays games and doesn't try, and that is in hacking and doesn't try to see how they can cheat in the game. For no reason. I don't believe there is a person here. But totally agree. And very nice point, very nice motivation point. And regarding to that, what's your mindset when you can't figure out what to do at the CTF, the game, at anything?
There are a few like tools that you can do. I guess the most common thing I do is just try to explain it to somebody else. If you play in a team, it's awesome. You can tell some other person re-explaining everything you did to like catch them up. If you don't have that, you can also just talk to yourself. I do that also. Just like, okay, refresh, let's start from the beginning, and I just really loudly speak out what I was doing, what I was observing, and what kind of information I derive from whatever I saw or so. Just like reiterate everything from the start, because sometimes I might have missed something. And yeah, programmers might know it. It's called rubber duck debugging, where you kind of like this the idea where you have a yellow rubber duck and you just speak to the duck and explain to them your bug, your issue, and then maybe by explaining it you find the solution. So yeah, it's this restarting again, reiterating, going through everything and speaking it out loudly, like really thoroughly explaining it as if another person would have to understand everything now, and that really helps to figure out what you missed. And then it depends a little bit on what you are working on, of course. For example, if you have source code available, the data flow is important for how data from the input leads maybe to something insecure. So when you have maybe been looking for where data is coming in and where it goes, you could turn it around. You could look for vulnerable places that could be interesting. And then you start to look, how could something reach that? Like changing the strategy, how you look for stuff.
Okay.
But it depends really on what kind of technology you are hacking on. But yeah, a change in strategy is another thing. And then taking breaks, you know, like as we talk, cooking or taking a shower to take a step back and let your mind just let the gears turn and maybe an idea plops up.
It's actually something that it helps me, at least, I don't know about the rest, like try to draw it, like try to sit down and put it in a paper and understand what you have done, what you have tested, where like try to create a map. I don't know, sometimes it creates a map in my mind of what I have done.
Drawing actually is a really good tip. I find myself a lot drawing, especially when you have more complex system where data is like, especially like browser and server, for example, an a modern authentication flow with tokens. There's a lot of, or OAuth also, there's a lot of back and forth and redirection to where tokens are passed to and whatever. Without drawing that, it's almost like impossible to kind of get a grasp on what's happening.
Exactly. So, exactly, like a flow diagram.
Yeah.
Exactly. So another question about YouTube. What do you miss about being a smaller YouTuber channel?
To me, there's really not much of a difference for the channel. I think people ask that question because other YouTubers, they create really communities and they interact closely with the people. And so they think back at the time where they knew everybody and suddenly it was so big that they didn't know everybody anymore or something like this. This is an experience I never had because I never wanted to be in the center of the channel and be it about me as a person. So I never wanted to like create a bubble around myself. So for me, the channel actually feels the same like the day I created it. I just make videos I find interesting and I just post them and I am happy when people like them. This was the same with the small channel and with the big channel as well.
Okay. So what I find, at least for your content, is that it hasn't changed. You have not changed because you're very young, but what is actually happening is that what you say is true, that the content you create is about security. It's not about live overflow and here's life and that kind of thing. So I understand a little bit what you say, that even if you, when you had 1,000 subscribers, or now that you have almost 700, I believe, it's the same content. So that's very nice for keeping it that way.
I could add to that, that over the time, of course, I got more comfortable showing myself as well. And I guess it's, or I like to think that it's important to show a bit of a presence for people to connect, to grow the channel more, because in the end, I want basically every person to at least have heard of the channel. And if they don't like it, it's fine. But I want to make sure that I reach this one kid somewhere in a village. He's the only, or they are the only computer nerd around, and they find this channel, and that's what they were looking for. I hope to reach like everybody, and I worry that I don't reach somebody. So my goal is just to have the biggest reach possible, to reach those people, and then I succeed. And so at some point, I started to experiment showing my face more. So in that sense, the videos have changed, that I appear more with my face, in the hope that this kind of more personal connection helps with the reach of the channel. Not, but it's not because I want to like, it's a balance between how I feel about it versus strategizing what's maybe for analytics the best thing to do.
Okay, I understand what you say. Have you ever became at a point in your life or anywhere that you said, I quit? I quit YouTube. I cannot do it anymore.
Only like time-wise, just because it takes a lot of time, and I don't earn that much from it. It doesn't compare to a professional job in InfoSec. I do get a bit of money from it, but yeah, it's no relation to doing security audits.
Okay.
And so, for me, if my situation would change, like if I would have to look more for about money, or if I would have to find a different job that wouldn't have this flexibility I have with my current job, so I couldn't do Live Overflow on the side, things like this would lead to Live Overflow not existing or stopping it. But yeah, so far nothing has changed in that regard. I'm still flexible, so I'm still able to do it. There's one video I made like a couple of months ago about that. I made every video I wanted ever to make.
And I remember it. Yeah.
They kind of reflected my feeling that I still have, is I kind of like covered everything I know, at least. I feel like when somebody is really watching all my videos, they know everything I know, basically. And so there's not much I can teach anymore. That's kind of the feeling I have. So
okay.
I feel like satisfied with what I put out there, and I wouldn't feel bad to kind of stop, because I feel like it gets harder and harder to provide something new to people. So I'm like satisfied with it now, so I wouldn't feel bad like stopping. But yeah, as I said, when some things would change, like job stuff, then you know, I might end Live Overflow, but yeah, so far it's still
wrong. Okay. But yeah, you may have taught some of the concepts, but since security will be evolving, you will always have to show something to the people.
Sure.
Okay, so the next question is, oh my God, where did my mouse go? Amazing. So we have a question. I watched your AFL video series about Sudan. It was very, very helpful. Do you think fanzine can be applied to port services like SNMP or SMTP as well? Information other series seems short of the matter, on the matter.
Yeah, of course. Like networks, fuzzing any kind of network protocol has been a thing for, you know, as long as fuzzing exists, probably. The difficulty, though, and that's why also there's not much information out there, is that it's very difficult to kind of like instrument and hook up network protocol and fuzzing for it. There are state changes happening during the whole network protocol. You have to become very creative in a way how you fuzz a network protocol. It's much easier. So basically, with regular fuzzing with the AFL videos, for example, is you give some input to a program, you let it run, and you check if it crashed. It's like a one-shot test. But with a network protocol, you have a lot of back and forth. You need to very carefully send certain kinds of messages that match the protocol. And so it's a lot more complex, and because it's more complex, it requires a lot more experience and so forth. It's obviously more state of the art, more experienced level information, and that's why you don't find it very much. The information is definitely out there. Like network protocol fuzzing is, as I said, a thing, but it gets complex, and you have to have a bit more experience. I have a two or three videos about an FFmpeg vulnerability on my videos. It's a very old video series. I think it might have been my very first collaboration with somebody. And this person fuzzed FFmpeg network protocol. So FFmpeg, the video conversion tool, FFmpeg.
Try to find the video in order to put it here.
So it's like three-part video. So, and this person did, FFmpeg network protocol fuzzing. And they had a very clever idea how they did that. That is a video I could recommend to you, some ideas. But the thing is, there's like no easy solution. Like, there's not a tool here, throw it on it and it will fuzz this port or something like this. Or maybe it kind of exists. But you reach a level of fuzzing where you have to be creative how to instrument it and how to work with it. This information doesn't really exist because it's very experienced stuff, so you know, maybe you could create that stuff when you learn about it. I want to have more experienced level tutorials out there as well, so you know, I would be happy if people make videos about something like that.
It's a video that you created like 5 months ago.
No, it's very old. I can share it really quickly.
Okay, yeah, maybe we can leave it maybe here in the chat for everyone. But very, very interesting. And
I can send it in the YouTube chat.
Of course, that would be amazing.
So these are the three videos that are related to this.
So, thank you for the amazing info. And another very techy question is, do you think apps, internals, browsers have been an unexplored attack vector? For example, Facebook's browser.
I don't think that they have been unexplored. I think they are definitely an explored attack vector because it is an attack vector. What has to be understood is that usually they, or generally like on a mobile app, they integrate the native web view. So it's not like a custom browser where you could like fuzz and hack it or something. It would be on iOS, for example, the basically Safari that you're interacting with and so forth. So from that sense, the browser itself is not really the attack vector, but how the internal browser is integrated with the app, it could be. For example, there could be native functions exposed to JavaScript. Mm-hmm. And so a website opened in that internal browser could maybe call special JavaScript functions that directly interact with the app itself. And so that is an attack surface, an input attack surface that you only have in that browser against the app itself. Or the app might react on HTTP requests that a site sends, and it intercepts them and returns something else. Basically, another way to send input to the app itself. So, yeah, the internal browser on apps could expose interesting input surfaces for attacker, for sure. Yeah, it's definitely something that is also looked at. For example, some games, some MMO games, they use actually HTML and JavaScript to make the interface. It's very common nowadays that games use really HTML and JavaScript for the interface. And when you have a checkbox there, you could maybe use XSS, for example, in the checkbox of the game. And okay. Then the interface obviously has to interact with the game, right? When you click on like an item or a skill in the bar, it's all HTML. So when you click on it, some JavaScript method has to interact with the game to say, use that skill or something. So now there are JavaScript functions to talk to the game. And now you could call these functions obviously from your XSS and cause havoc. I'm not sure, I haven't been like super into it, but I think I heard that the new Worlds game, for example, had these kind of XSS type issues in the in the game, where you're using the chat, you could send XSS payloads and then again access these native functions to crash the game for others.
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, it's not unexplored, but it's, I guess, an attack vector that maybe some people don't know about or think about. And so that's certainly an area where bug hunters can maybe spend some time on. It's definitely a more obscure or interesting attack vector.
Yeah, that's very nice. And another question is, how do you choose a topic for research or going deep into it? How do you approach it? How you decide what is your next thing to learn?
So it's either CTFs or work. So either a CTF challenge introduces me to a new technology I don't know about, and usually CTF challenges are well designed, so they direct you to the goal. A very good CTF challenge does that. So in a CTF challenge it might be very clear that this certain library is used, and so it means, okay, I gotta have to research this library now and then maybe uncover something interesting that I can use for the CTF. And the same thing happens at work. Maybe I notice something fishy or something feels weird, and a library is maybe used in an interesting way. And so I start looking into that library and read the code and, you know, research that. Or they use a new technology that I haven't seen before. For example, you know, there was a point where Docker didn't exist. So suddenly clients had Docker containers using in their application, and I haven't known Docker before. So suddenly Docker becomes a new thing to learn. This is obviously a few years back, but yeah, new technologies are introduced by clients, and then it's obviously my responsibility to start learning about them and trying to find security relevant things about them so I can then do a security audit for it.
And okay, and what is the latest thing that you started researching, like the new technology, like the most recent one, on something that you started yesterday, don't know?
Yeah, that's a good question. Okay, let me think. Because there's so much technology stuff, I now need to think back. Because it's kind of like something very natural and normal that I look into libraries of client applications, of course. But I'm trying to think also if there's like something like bigger. I guess the biggest research area for me was going a bit deeper with Docker, and especially the networking, how ports are exposed and services are exposed, and how you can reach other things maybe, and how you can isolate them from each other. When you have a more complex setup with a lot of microservices and single instances, and you want to, and you do this maybe for security reasons because you want to isolate those things, and then suddenly you realize they are not isolated at all because the Docker networking doesn't even support it in that way or so. And yeah, suddenly you uncover, you understand like internally a bit more how the whole architecture works. I think this was the latest biggest topic I was looking into.
That's very interesting. And how is it going as of now, that research over there?
Sorry?
How is the research going over there?
Oh, yeah, no. I completed this. So I realized that things were not isolated. And then I was able to do things with that. Actually, another thing I just remember, this is actually very just this week. I have very little experience with Windows. And I'm currently looking at a Windows regular like native application and
like a C client, you mean?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And it's doing stuff with the registry. And now, for example, my research question was, is it possible to lock down the registry entry so that only the software itself can change it and that no other software or, for example, malware could change that registry entry? And so I had to learn about how Windows uses security identifiers and how the permission system in that case works. And if maybe there are things could also change, you know, maybe Windows has introduced something where signatures of the process are used. So maybe the software is signed. And so when it changes in the registry, you could say only with my signature, I'm allowed to change it. Is that something that Windows supports or so? This is just a research question. I don't know. So far, I'm still in the middle of that research. But so far, for example, I think I've learned, maybe somebody else can correct me and tell me, but so far I've learned that this is, for example, not possible. The only permission differences is that you have to kind of like create different Windows accounts, like service accounts, and then they basically are the isolation then, but it doesn't work, for example, on a process level. That's something I think I learned. Hopefully somebody can correct me, but for example, something I'm just right now digging into and I have no clue like what's possible or not.
Well, actually, that's very interesting. I don't know. It's very good. It's very nice. It's very good for like, it's food for thought. Yeah. And it's...
For example, and just maybe to explain the context, I'm a bit more experienced with macOS. And on macOS, applications and processes are signed. So a lot of like system APIs you interact to with, you can like lock them down to the signature of your app. So another app cannot like mess with your stuff because the operating system itself is aware, okay, this process or this application is signed by this developer and only other applications signed by the same developer can interact with each other. So this is like system level protection. And so now I come to Windows and I ask myself, is this possible there as well? Can I, does Windows care about like signatures of processes to lock down the registry entries for that process, for example? That's like a research question I came up with due to my experience with Mac.
Nice. Whoa. I cannot wait to see a video like that. That would be very interesting. Or maybe your research in a tweet or something, the result, please send it.
It's so in the end, like it's not really so security relevant or interesting to most people because it's a very specific use case. This one app really wants to make sure the registry entries cannot be changed by a basic malware. That's kind of like the threat model there. And it's very rare threat model. That for most apps, it's probably doesn't really matter or so. I need to research that to be able to have a good answer for the client.
Okay. So interesting. Let's see how that goes. Or if we have anyone that is actually working on that right now, it would be nice if you want guys to comment it or maybe.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully we have a Windows expert who can just tell me, you're such an idiot. Here is how the signature stuff works on Windows. Yeah, this works actually. That would be awesome.
Let me ping someone from our team that we have that is a Windows expert. Where is Mr. Ben when you need him? I will ping him later and he write the comments. The next one and last is, have you ever thought of starting your own cybersecurity company?
So technically, when you don't want to do tax evasion and everything in Germany and other countries, you have to register some kind of company once you earn money. And because Live Overflow earns a bit of money, I guess I have a cybersecurity company behind Live Overflow. So yeah, I guess I have one. But I guess the question is also more in the direction of maybe cybersecurity services, like doing pen testing as my own company or so. But I'm very happy in the technical position I am right now as a basic tester. Once you start a company, you have to do a lot of overhead and other stuff. You know, you are organizing the company. You have to do a lot of non-technical things. You have to deal with accounting and so forth. And I've already enough of that. I really don't want more of that. And so I have absolutely no motivation, drive, or interest in creating like my own consulting business, for example. Really no motivation for that.
And I think that will move you away from your target that you said earlier in our stream, that you want to become better and better and better at what you do. And if you start your own company, you lose focus from that. It is like the brand, the finance, the marketing, the operations, anything else around security.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe not now, but who knows in the future.
Yeah, I mean, as I said very early in the interview, I could even imagine to go back into like development and doing architecture, like stuff, architecture, IT architecture, design stuff or so. So yeah, the future is open, but I don't see myself as running like a consultancy or something like that.
Okay, fair enough. And I think no one wants to lose you from his or her YouTube, you know, his YouTube things to watch, because I don't really think you will have time to do it. So that was all from us. It lasted more. We kept you 30 minutes more than we promised. We're very sorry, but it was very interesting talk, actually. And thank you very much, Live-O, for your time today. Anything that you would like to say or like close the stream today?
First of all, thanks for having me. I'm always happy to talk about my experience. I hope people could derive some of it for their own unique path that they are walking on. Maybe got some ideas to try out or check out. Other than that, I can say do whatever is fun to you, stay curious, dig deeper, and don't dig deeper and look into the stuff, how things actually work, and then do that more.
That's very nice. We have an answer. We have someone saying in the comments, have you looked into Parsons registry access rules? You can lock registry modifications to certain Windows account, not up level but closure.
That's what I was saying. What I figured out was that it's like on accounts level, you could create like a service account or something like this for the app, their own account, and then they could like lock it to only their own account or something like this. But yeah, it's not on the app level. That's matching what I was what I learned so far.
Okay. Yeah. That's so interesting. Thank you for your time today and for your talk. We look forward to see how this research is going. We will be waiting to see a tweet or something about Windows, the necessary evil. So thank you very much. Have amazing holidays because they're approaching. Be safe, be happy, be healthy, and keep...
That just reminds me, one more thing I want to say, get vaccinated, please. German Corona numbers go insane right now, and it would be really great if everybody would get vaccinated. Thank you.
That's very nice. And to be honest, I totally agree more with you. We need to be able to go back to real life again. So totally agree with you. Nice message there. Thank you very much. Wish you all the best. Keep rocking. Keep up the amazing work. We cannot wait to see more amazing videos. Bye, Live-O.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, have a good weekend. Bye-bye.
And that was all, guys. Thank you very much for your time today. Thank you for tuning in. thank you, Live-O, for your time, everyone. Yes, we really thank for everything. Everyone loves this talk. Guys, stay tuned. Amazing things are going to come up soon. Other interesting interviews. And we really want, and we cannot appreciate the opportunity you had today. Stay curious, have fun, and we wish you to be safe. That's all. Bye from me.
And that's all for today's AMA. Join our Discord at discord.gg/hackthebox. Check us out on Instagram and Twitter at hackthebox, and see you next episode.